So I'll just start by giving you a little bit of background. I got started on this project when I went to Oregon State to work on my master's and PhD, and then about, I guess it's been 4 years already, went up to British Columbia as a postdoc with Agriculture, Agri-Food Canada, and now I'm working for the berry industries up in BC. A little bit of an overview of how this all got started and the way this is structured is we wanted to look at diversity a couple of different ways. One is looking at phenotypic diversity, so just evaluating germplasm in the field. Also in the greenhouse, aphid resistance is a really big issue in black and red raspberry, and then also performance in the field. But then also on the other side of things, you can only get so far just looking at phenotypic diversity, especially with wild germplasm. So we really want to look at allelic diversity, because really at the end of the day, that's what we're interested in. So we started looking at diversity of genetic markers. When we started this, there weren't a whole lot of markers for black raspberry, so we did some studies looking at transferability of other Rubus SSR markers to use in black raspberry, and then we did some analyses of population structure and diversity. And then ultimately, the goal for the whole project is to tie both of these things together and develop the genomic tools. So a little bit of a background here. Black raspberry, Rubus occidentalis, it's a diploid, relatively small genome, and it's native to most of eastern North America from about New Brunswick down to the Carolinas, west into Arkansas and eastern Oklahoma, and sort of up through the eastern part of the Great Plains. It's a relatively recently domesticated crop. The first known named cultivar was in 1832. It was called Ohio Everbearer for its unique ability to primacane fruit, which means it fruits in the fall on first-year canes in addition to second-year canes, which is normal for raspberries. By 1867, there were 11 reported cultivars. 1893, the first breeding program working on black raspberries started in Geneva, New York. And 1897, the variety Munger was released. That's notable only because Munger today accounts for about, 99% of the acreage in Oregon, which is really about 80% of the acreage in North America. Although that said, Munger then probably is not the same thing that we're growing and calling Munger today. By 1925, there were at least 193 cultivars recognized by U.P. Hedrick in his Small Fruits of New York, and he considered the future of the black raspberry to be a most promising one. But not long after that, progress in breeding black raspberries really started to stall. And there was a variety of disease issues that people were encountering, leading to short planting life. By 1975, people thought that genetic variability or a lack of genetic variability in the elite germplasm was a major limiting factor. And since then, we've only had a few cultivars that have been released. 1996 Early Sweet was the first one released that has a species other than occidentalis in its pedigree, although I will say that according to our markers, that also looks doubtful. There may have been some mislabeling there, so it's still a little bit up in the air there. But the black raspberry industry today, there's been a lot of demand, increase in demand over the last 15 years or so for black raspberry fruit. A lot of it is because of good press from potential health benefits of eating black raspberries. But at the same time, the industry is limited by a number of production issues, particularly related to disease. So we have insect-vectored viruses. Aphid-vectored viruses are a major factor. We also have verticillium wilt issues. And progress in breeding to get around these problems has been limited by a narrow genetic base. So we started to look at this really, I guess it was probably Chad started looking at Black Raspberry about 2000, so about 15 years ago. And they did some crosses, and I came in, and this was part of my master's project, was looking at a dial-L of Black Raspberry cultivars, and we had a couple of wild sessions in there as well. We found the traits of interest were fairly heritable, but the variation was really limited to just a couple of genotypes. And one of those genotypes that really showed a lot of promise in that initial study was a wild selection from North Carolina. And so that led us to say, okay, well, maybe we should be looking at this wild germplasm a little bit more closely, because nobody's really looked at wild black raspberry germplasm and done a thorough evaluation over the whole range of things in 100 years. So maybe we should be taking a look at this. So we applied for some funding, got some funding to do some collecting. We also wrote to people, asked them to, if they have black raspberries growing near them, send us seed. So we went on two collecting trips, one along the southern edge of the range, with Kim Hummer and myself, and then later that summer, this would have been 2007, Chad Finn and I also collected along the western edge of the range in the Great Plains. And then we filled in a lot of the range with people sending us fruit from all over. So from this, we ended up with plants from 150-some locations across the range. Most of these we planted seed out for replicated field plantings. So we had about 2,600 seedlings that went into replicated in the plantings in the field. 78 of these populations went in the fall of 2007. We didn't have all the seed right away, so the remaining 31 populations went in May of 2008. They went in as four replications in blocks with three to four seedlings per plot, and the different planting dates were randomized separately. So these are the plots that were planted in September of 2007. Additional seed from the summer of 2007 led to seedlings going in May of 2008. And then there were some seed lots that we didn't have very good germination on, so they went in as the border rows and just sort of extra plants for observation plots. Now, I have to say, so this is, as we're planting the field, you can see the layout here, and this is what it looked like a couple years later as we're evaluating this. And we looked at a bunch of different traits, aphid resistance, vigor, rated verticillium wilt symptoms in the field, winter cane injury, plant architecture, a bunch of phenology, fruit size, appearance, some chemistry in the traits. Everything that we looked at, we found significant variation. Now, I don't have time up here to talk about all these different things, and I don't want to bore you either, so I'm only going to highlight a couple of these, and that's the aphid resistance, because it's really important, and then some of the chemistry and fruit quality as well. Before all of these plants went out into the field, they were all in the greenhouse, and when they were in the greenhouse, we started evaluating for them for aphid resistance when they're about this tall, about 5 or 6 inches. And so this is Amphorophora agathonica. It's the large raspberry aphid, and it is a vector for black raspberry necrosis virus, which is our main virus in black raspberries in Oregon. It also carries a few different viruses in red raspberries up in northwest Washington and southwest British Columbia. This virus has been attributed to as one of the major reasons for decline in black raspberry fields in Oregon, and fields are nearly 100% infected after only two seasons. So that's a major concern for the growers. If you have no resistance to these aphids and you have these viruses that are transmitted very quickly, you get transmission within 15 or 30 minutes of feeding very easily. So these viruses move into the field, and commercial fields really are only lasting about 3 or 4 seasons in Oregon, and that's a huge cost for the growers. But also what happens is it leads to a huge amount of turnover on a year-to-year basis in the industry. And the problem with that is it leads to unpredictable supply. So your pricing starts to go like this, and your supply does this to follow it, and people start to pull out of the market because they don't know what they're going to pay for product to use as an ingredient on a year-to-year basis. And so we really need more stability in, we need more plant longevity to help us with stability in the marketplace, and hopefully that will contribute to the long-term viability of this industry. So I mentioned we screened all these for aphid resistance in the greenhouse. We actually screened about 7,000 seedlings in 2007 and 2008 for aphid resistance in the greenhouse. And we do that by taking three adult aphids and putting them on each plant, and then going back a week later and counting the aphids on each plant. And as you can imagine, that takes a lot of time. So we have a bit of a shortcut. If we see more than 10 aphids, we just stop counting and we say, okay, that's susceptible. If there's fewer than 10 aphids, we'd make a note of the number. And if there were fewer than three aphids, we'd add aphids back onto it to give it three adult aphids. And typically, if something was susceptible, this is what it would look like after about 3 weeks. So you can see this is Munger here, and it is heavily colonized by the aphids. We did find some resistance. So this is ORUS 3778-1. It's a selection that came out of wild seed from Ontario. And about half of the seedlings in this seed lot were resistant. This is 3817-1. This came from seed from Gardner, Maine, that was sent to us. And all 72 of the seedlings that we screened from this seed lot were resistant. And then this one is ORUS 4109-1, and it came from Michigan. And we screened 36 seedlings in this seed lot, and one was resistant. So we started doing crosses with these to look at segregation for aphid resistance and to develop mapping populations that we could use down the road. The first thing we found out was that with the resistance from Ontario and Maine, the first generation, everything turned out to be resistant. So our parents were probably homozygous for resistance at that stage, so we had to do another generation of crosses. So that's why the numbers are a little bit different here. And we did get segregation. So do we have a laser pointer by any chance? I didn't think, I can use the mouse for now. So this 4153-1 is resistance from Ontario, and we named this resistance gene AG4, and we saw one-to-one segregation in the second generation there, so that indicates to us that it is likely a single dominant gene. ORUS 4158-2 represents the second generation of resistance from Maine, and we had an excess of resistant plants in this population. And then 4109-1 segregated one-to-one as well. That's the resistance from Michigan. Our excess of resistant plants from the main source of resistance, there's a couple of possible reasons for that. One is linkage of susceptible lethal allele in Jewel, which is a grandparent on both sides of that cross. Another possibility is that there is a duplication of linked genes in there. So we're still working on that and trying to find out exactly what's going on with that. Why study the fruit quality of this wild germplasm? I mentioned the fruit quality traits a little bit earlier. Really, there's a few reasons. So we know we want aphid resistance, but the fruit quality, we'd really like to be able to identify germplasm with superior fruit quality characteristics. So if we can increase our anthocyanin and pigment concentration, that would be fantastic, because that's one of the major quality parameters. At the same time, if we have germplasm that we're bringing in for disease resistance, we would really like to know if we're introducing negative fruit quality traits into our breeding lines that we need to be careful about and select for. And overall, it just better informs the decisions that we make on crossing parents so that we can counteract these potential quality impacts of otherwise useful germplasm. There was a huge range of anthocyanins in black raspberry. This is from the Dial-L, where we found that the Dial-L with the named varieties mostly, and we found basically a twofold difference in anthocyanin concentration in that study. When we look at the wild germplasm, there was a much larger range. So you'll see the range here from 244 to 541, and I see this got cut off on the top, but that's in milligrams per 100 mils of juice. These are the lowest normally pigmented black raspberries for anthocyanin concentration over a two-year period, the five lowest and the five highest. And generally speaking, if they were high in 1 year, they were high in both years, but that was not always the case. You can see there's this one here, this 291.8 in 1 year, and it was one of the highest in the second year. I will point out this 3817 right here, this population is one of our sources of aphid resistance. So it turns out it was one of our highest ones for anthocyanin concentration. So that was really good. It also turns out that it was really high in Brix and high acidity, which is also good for our processing industry. So within the range of individual genotypes, not just population averages, but individual genotypes that we sampled, we had a range of from 39 to almost 1,000 milligrams per 100 mils of juice. So there's a 25-fold difference in anthocyanin concentration in these wild seedlings. And slide was not advancing. There it is. This is just a picture showing some of the diversity in how these fruit look. If you look at these two up at the top from Ontario, that's one of our sources of aphid resistance. There was some segregation for fruit gloss in that population, and but most of the populations as a whole generally were fairly uniform in terms of fruit appearance. Rich Mountain, South Carolina, down there in the lower left, is one of our populations of interest. Extremely vigorous. There were, I can't remember exactly, I want to say 52 rows or something like that in this field. It was a 2-acre field. And you could stand on one end of the field and you could pick out each of the four reps of this population from Rich Mountain, South Carolina, because they were about a foot and a half or 2 feet taller than anything else. We did have some yellow or orange-fruited mutants in the population, and then there's just a photo of Munger for comparison down the lower right. With the anthocyanin composition, we also noticed some mutants in these populations. So this top photo, this top graph here, these are the different anthocyanins of black raspberry. This is fairly typical what we see in the cultivars. We had this population from South Dakota, actually a couple populations from South Dakota, where we noticed a few differences. So some individuals, or we had this extra little blip right here representing pelargonidin 3 glucoside, which we don't normally see in the cultivars. And then individuals, some other ones, we had more missing anthocyanins, where we really only saw cyanidin 3 sambibiocide, cyanidin 3 glucoside, and pelargonidin 3 glucoside. So we're looking at this, scratching our heads, figuring out, well, what's going on here? And it suddenly dawned on me, I said, I shouldn't be looking at what is here, I should be looking at what's not here. And when I did that, I realized that what's missing in these are all of the rutinicides. So we don't have cyanidin 3 xylosyl rutinicide, we don't have cyanidin 3 rutinicide, we don't have pelargonidin 3 rutinicide, we don't have pionidin 3 rutinicide. We have this extra glucoside here, this 4, and this pelargonidin 3 glucoside, but not pelargonidin 3 rutinicide. Well, pelargonidin 3 glucoside is the precursor for pelargonidin 3 rutinicide. So the way this happens in black raspberry is that we have the glucoside, you add arannose, and it turns into a rutinicide. You add xylose, and it becomes sambibiocide. And if you have Xylos and Rhamnos, then you have Xylosyl-rutinoside. So we were seeing pelargonidin-3-glucoside, but not pelargonidin-3-rutinoside. The lack clued us in what was going on was we actually had a knockout mutation in our gene for Rhamnosyl transferase, so we weren't getting the addition of this Rhamnos to the anthocyanin, and that's why we weren't seeing any of the rutinosides. And that's why we had these three, but none of the others. There's also a difference in the proportion of the major anthocyanins that we were picking up between some of the wild populations and some of the cultivars, so that's kind of interesting, but we're not quite sure what that means. And then switch gears here and start talking about the molecular part of this project and why we're developing molecular markers. Initially, the impetus was if we had molecular markers, we could really lower the cost of potentially of screening seedlings and selections for aphid resistance, because putting aphids on every single seedling year after year after year is a lot of work, and it's also a lot of work to maintain aphid colonies over time in the greenhouse when you're not actively using them. Developing molecular markers for aphid resistance would also help us understand linkages between resistance and other traits that we're interested in or that we're perhaps trying to avoid, for example. And resistances or linkages between different aphid resistance sources themselves. And then finally, it would also facilitate the ability to combine or pyramid these resistance genes for increased durability. One of the things we've seen in red raspberry, where we have had aphid resistance for a long time, these are the first aphid resistance genes described in black raspberry, by the way, where we've had aphid resistance in red raspberry for a long time, we've seen sequential breakdown of resistance genes each time one of them gets added. So what we'd really like to do is be able to protect these. We only have a few of them. We want to be able to combine them and hopefully have that resistance be more durable to the aphids, because if they break down, then either we have to start over from scratch and hope we find more resistant sources in the wild, or we're right back where we started from. And then ultimately, molecular markers are going to help us inform decisions regarding what germplasm to save and utilize in further breeding. And this is, again, getting back to the idea of looking for alleles and allelic diversity to bring into our breeding populations, not just phenotypic diversity. Especially with wild germplasm, a lot of the potentially positive traits that you're looking for, if they're quantitative, you may have some really good alleles in your wild populations, but they may be totally masked or hidden by really bad alleles for the same things. So by increasing the overall allelic diversity that we're going to be selecting from, we're going to enable ourselves to be able to eventually start to pull some of those out and make progress. Sort of a backtrack here, what are molecular markers? I expect most of you probably have some sort of idea of what molecular markers are. Essentially, we're talking about variant DNA sequences or characteristics. So for the purposes of this morning, we'll mostly be talking about simple sequence repeat or microsatellite markers, and that's a size difference between two known sequences. So you get a band that amplifies, and depending on the number of repeats that are between these two known sequences, you get a variation in your band size. And then single nucleotide polymorphism is exactly what it sounds like. It's basically a base pair change at a single base. So it's you know what the flanking sequences are, and you have just a variation where maybe an A becomes a G or a C or something like that. And there's lots of different types of molecular markers out there, and it's basically an alphabet soup, all kinds of different acronyms for all of these. We're not going to go into the details of what all these other markers are, but for the purposes of just understanding, we're talking about variant sequences that can be either just randomly across the genome, depending on what you want to do with it, or hopefully we can find some that are linked to traits of interest. When we started this, there really weren't any markers in black raspberry. but there were some microsatellite markers that had been developed in red raspberry and some that had been developed in blackberry. So we started out by screening those to see which ones we could amplify in black raspberry, and of those, which ones were polymorphic or showed differences for us. And from that, we came up with a few, but not too many. Only we ended up with about just under two dozen out of almost 150 that we screened in the initial populations. Looking at, if I go back here, we started out looking at doing optimum annealing temperatures as well. So this is actually a gradient you can't really see. This is 50 degrees, this is 65 degrees. So we're trying to find the optimum annealing temperatures for these different SSRs. And then we put them in a panel of diverse wild genotypes and see which ones show different sizes. So this is our SSR marker. I said we're looking for a size difference in these bands, and you can see there's a lot of size differences here showing up on this gel. And so from this, we wanted to do diversity analysis. Just what kind of diversity do we have in these wild populations? Is it really that much more than what we see in the cultivars? What can we pull out of this? So we took 137 wild and 21 cultivated accessions. This basically is one plant from each of our wild populations, and we also included all the accessions that were in the germplasm repository. And so we ran our markers in all of these. And the first thing we noticed was we came up with some pedigree discrepancies. So Huron is supposed to be a cross between Rachel and Dundee, but if you look at this, we find that it does not have alleles that can be explained by its supposed parents, but it appears to be closely related to Jewel. It has some alleles from Jewel. Whereas Jewel is supposed to be a cross between Bristol and Dundee, back cross to Dundee. And if you look at Bristol and Dundee, we have alleles in Jewel that are not in either Bristol or Dundee. So there's definitely some pedigree discrepancies that we uncovered. It helps this helped us to better understand the relationships between the varieties that we did have. They weren't necessarily what we thought they were going to be. And then looking at overall diversity here, we found that basically all of the cultivars and some of the wild populations all ended up in this part of the tree up here. For the most part, there was not a whole lot of geographic matching up of a lot of these. The exception would be there's this big group here that's mostly from Tennessee, although there's an accession here from Georgia, one from North Carolina, one from Kentucky, one from Maryland, and one from New York that ended up in there. So there's, you know, but there is this big group that's largely from the southeast. But we also see pairings of things like here, Gardner, Maine, and Nebraska City, Nebraska. Probably not due to being related at all there. That's just the way this ends up sometimes. You know, with microsatellite markers, one of the things that we do expect is to see low bootstrap values associated with these sorts of trees. One thing we noticed as well, we looked at heterozygosity overall and also in individual populations. We found that our wild accessions, we had about half of observed heterozygosity was about half of what was expected based on the allelic diversity that was there. So very low heterozygosity, relatively speaking, in the wild, whereas our cultivars, we actually have higher than expected heterozygosity based on the allelic diversity. So that tells us a couple things. One is the cultivars were probably, this is probably an artifact of selection. So in the process of selecting for genotypes that perform better, we are actually selecting for ones that are heterozygous, which runs contrary to the notion that perhaps there isn't a whole lot of inbreeding depression in black raspberry. I think there's probably some, because when we're selecting, we're increasing the heterozygosity. same time, in the wild populations, there appears to be some inbreeding or some isolation going on, and that's why we have this lower than expected heterozygosity. We want to take a little bit more of a different approach to looking at this, so we said, okay, let's look at population structure, looking at admixture and detecting relationships that are not necessarily immediately obvious from our dendrogram and from doing principal components analysis. Also, just sort of give us a better understanding of the diversity across the range. Do we have some parts of the range that are diversity hotspots and other parts of the range where we have very low diversity? How is it distributed geographically? And ultimately, how is our wild germplasm related to our cultivars? So, to go on with this a little bit, there are a number of programs out there now that let us look at population structure, and they ever since these MC Markov chain Monte Carlo simulations became available, it actually became computationally possible to do Bayesian clustering of genetic data. And the programs that are out there are all essentially designed to identify the optimum K, or the number of genetic clusters that are in a data set. Structure was really the first program that came out that gave us the ability to do this, and it's still probably the most popular choice. Not necessarily the best choice, but it's probably the most widely used one still. There's other ones out there. Structurama, for example, is another one. And then there's this program Instruct, which uses a very similar algorithm to Structure, but it relaxes assumptions of random mating and Hardy-Weinberg equilibrium. So that lets us look at things that we know are either self-compatible or possibly inbreeding in our populations, which is a huge advantage because Structure is really not designed to do that. Structure was actually originally written for looking at human and mammalian genotypes. So these programs weren't necessarily written initially with the idea of looking at plant populations where selfing can happen. And so that's where Instruct comes along. The other nice advantage to Instruct, or another nice advantage to Instruct, is that it allows you to calculate individual and population selfing rates, which is really interesting and a huge advantage. So just what is K? I mentioned it on the previous slide, trying to find the optimum number of genetic clusters in the data. If we think about genetic population structure this way, it's basically the presence of systematic differences in allele frequencies among subpopulations in a population. And presumably these are going to be due to differences in ancestry. What K then is, it's the modeled number of subpopulations in these Bayesian simulations. So following Bayesian sampling and clustering of genotype data, we can test at varying levels of K and figure out what level of K is the best set to explain the data that we have. And K, then the number of subpopulations in our data set, is really influenced by a whole host of things. One would be your mating system. So are you an outcrosser or are you a selfer? Population dynamics is also a huge thing. So dispersal rates, potential of distance for dispersal, glaciation and recolonization, a whole bunch of different things can influence the number of subpopulations that you see in any given data set. So that's something to keep in mind. I'll give you an example here, and this is not, I apologize, I edited my slides a little bit last night, so these are not, these couple of slides here are not in the handouts. But here's a paper from Molecular Ecology a few years ago looking at balsam poplar. And essentially, you know, so this is a woody species, so we have a perennial species. You're going to see less population structure because there's overlapping generations than you would see necessarily in an annual species where there's no overlap in the generations. Balsam poplar is also wind pollinated. and wind dispersed. So you get a lot of potential for outcrossing and for gene flow, and then also for colonization to happen fairly rapidly over space. And what we see here in this paper was they looked at balsam poplar across the range from Alaska all the way into the maritime provinces of Canada, and they found a K of 3. Okay, so we have one genetic cluster that appears to be primarily in the northwest part of the range, and another cluster that appears primarily represented in the very eastern part of the range, and sort of this mix in the middle that maybe came from the northwest and has moved around. You know, there's other factors to look at here. So things like where are your rare alleles that are not necessarily represented in other populations? That gives you a hint of where the most diversity is and where migrations have happened to or from. So you expect areas that have been migrated into to have gone through some bottlenecking, and so they don't have as much diversity, for example. This is pretty typical. If you look at a lot of these studies, usually we're talking about fairly low values of K over a large geographic area. Another thing to think about with K is it's not necessarily a very straightforward thing. You can say, okay, well, I'm just going to throw my data into this program and give it some parameters, and it's going to spit out an answer for me, and everything's going to be great. It's going to be nice and neat and pretty, and we're going to have our answer, and it'll be great. It doesn't necessarily work that way. There was a paper that came out a couple years ago that reviewed archived data from a whole bunch of population structure analyses, and they found that using the parameters that were in those papers, so they used the same data set, the same methods, the same program parameters to analyze those data sets. And for 30% of those analyses, they weren't able to reproduce the same number of population clusters or the same level of K that the authors got when they did their analysis. So that's a huge problem. And the factors that they identified were insufficient burn-in and run length. So essentially, they're not letting their Bayesian simulations run long enough to reach convergence at the end of those chains. And so if you have a simulation that doesn't resample enough times or run enough long enough, you may end up with different answers. Insufficient replication of those runs to be able to reproduce bar plots is especially important for methods of choosing K that rely on looking at the variance. If you don't have very much replication, you have a much larger variance, and it throws things off a bit. And then the method which they use to choose K, and it's not necessarily a straightforward thing, and there's lots of different ideas about the best way to choose what the optimum K is in a data set. And actually, it's fairly common to look at some of these papers and see, this is what we think K is, but here's what it looks like at, here's what our data clustering looks like at several different levels of K, because that allows you to look a little bit at the hierarchical structure, but it also is sort of symptomatic, I guess, is of the inherent difficulties of identifying what the optimum K is. So they came up with some recommendations from this paper. One is that our computing power is a lot better than it used to be. They recommend a minimum burn-in of 100,000 iterations on these simulations. Every data set's going to be different, so we should say that at the outset. They're all going to be different based on the number of individuals you've sampled, the number of loci you're looking at, the amount of diversity in those data sets. So every data set's going to be different, but they say minimum you should be looking at least 100,000 iterations, and the best thing to do is to check for convergence of your chains at the end of this to see, really, are we coming up with the same end result if we do this over and over and over again. And then there's a program called CLUMP, which helps to order output so that you can replicate runs and combine these and average the results. And the recommendation they came up with in this paper was looking at least 20 replicate runs to give us a good idea of what's going on. And then ultimately, how K is chosen is really a factor of model fit and model complexity. So identifying the way this originally was set up with the idea and structure was to look at the log probability of each level of K. So you run these simulations for different scenarios of K. And you look at the log probability of those data sets at each level of K and see, okay, where does it level off? So at what point are we unnecessarily adding more levels here? We're always going to expect to see slightly better fit as we increase our levels of K potentially, but we're also losing degrees of freedom at the same time. So where's the trade-off? Where do we stop adding so much information that we lose our power to be able to see what's going on? And it's not necessarily a straightforward thing. So somebody came out about 5 years after Structure came out. They came out with a method which they looked at delta K, and they ran these simulations. And I'll just, with this data set here, this is microsatellite data. This is the same data set using different scenarios. So this is an island model here. And it's very clear at K equals 5 is sort of our optimum here. We see log probability really levels off at K equals 5. This is a different island model that allows for some mixing between islands. So it's a little bit more complex, but you also see again, K equals 5, this levels off, and it's fairly obvious our real K here, our optimum K is K equals 5 for explaining this data set. When we look at a contact model instead of an island model, well, suddenly it becomes a lot less clear, okay? If you sort of look at this, here's K equals 5 right here, and you can say, okay, well, it's kind of leveling off at K equals 5, but it still goes up at 6, goes up at 7, goes up at 8, up a little bit more at 9, up at 10. Well, it really levels off at 10, maybe, right? I don't know. I mean, it's kind of anybody's guess what you say is the best fit for this. So Ivano et al. In 2005 came out and they looked at this and they developed what they called delta K. So they're looking at the second order rate change of K to figure out when they're looking at this log probability, at what point do you see the biggest change in log probability? And that's what delta K is. It's a second order rate change. And they found with this data set, oh, we see this big spike at 5. And that kind of makes sense. Going back and looking at this, you see a big jump here and then a little jump. And so they say, okay, delta K equals 5 for this data set. So a whole bunch of people started using this method. And it's not necessarily the best method out there. It has its shortcomings. And we'll see some of that in a minute. Especially higher levels of K, it starts to fall apart. But the other shortcoming is when you are looking at a second order rate change, there's no possible way to test the hypothesis of K equals 1. Mathematically, the best you can do is K equals 2. And I've actually reviewed a number of papers where people use this delta K method and they said, okay, our K equals 2. And I said, how do you know? How do you know K equals 2? You never tested K equals 1. And inevitably, a lot of these, they go back and they use a different method and they test K equals 1. Guess what? K equals 1 is a better fit. So if you use this method, one thing to keep in mind is that if you get an answer of K equals 2, go back and test your data using something else, because it may be K equals 1 and you just don't know it. Instruct uses a different way of looking at this. It uses a statistic called the deviance information criterion. And there was a paper came out last year in PLOS One that looked at the performance of the deviance information criterion compared to delta K, compared to log probability, the F model and structure, and compared to some others. It actually found that the deviance information criterion with the data sets they were looking at performed better at higher levels of K than these other options did. And so they made the case that really the deviance information criterion is a better statistic to use. That may be the case in a lot of scenarios, but I can also, from our own experience and doing a little digging, found out that one of the disadvantages of the deviance information criterion is that it tends to not penalize models enough for adding things in. And so it tends to be biased towards overfitted models or higher levels of K than actually exist. And we ran into that with Black Raspberry. So determining K really is an imperfect science, and maybe the best thing to do in a lot of cases is to look at several different levels of K, because that may be the most informative to tell us what's going on with how clusters are arranged across the range. And this is an area, there's stuff coming out all the time trying to pin down the best way to look at K. In our Black Raspberry data, we had two data sets. One was looking at one individual from all of the populations that we sampled, as well as some of the cultivars, and another data set was looking at about 16 individuals from each of 30 populations to sample things a different way. And we ran that using Instruct because we knew that there was inbreeding going on in some of our wild populations because of our lower than expected heterozygosity. And this is what the log probability of K looks like in that Black Raspberry data. And it's not entirely clear. Maybe it levels off at 20, maybe it levels off down here at around 10 somewhere. I don't know. It's kind of messy. It's not like those island models that we were looking at a few slides back. It's much more like that contact model. When we looked at the deviance information criterion from Instruct, it gave us a optimum K of K equals 24. And we went, really? Wow. And then we graphed this and looked, well, the deviance information criterion, it's looking for an absolute value here. And the absolute lowest one was at K equals 24, and then it starts to go back up. But really, is K equals 24 really that different from K equals 20? You have to look at these things sort of critically. So we started playing around with this and saying, okay, well, what happens if we use Ivano's method and look at delta K? Well, I don't know what to make of that. You know, are we going to say K equals 2? Because that's the highest one on this graph? Well, that seems a little bit contrary to what we were getting from the other. So, I don't know. But then also looking at some of the reports, maybe delta K isn't the best choice. It doesn't necessarily perform very well at higher levels of K. It kind of falls apart. So the method we came up with is actually we looked at the variance in our models. And we saw that even though DIC was saying K equals 24 was sort of the best, we knew it leveled off somewhere around 20 or so. But when we look at the variance, we have this nice relatively level variance here in our models. And then from the jump between K equals 18 and K equals 19, all of a sudden our variance in our models starts to climb exponentially. We see very little change in the DIC. The DIC starts to climb back up, but there's a huge change in our variance. And so this allows us to at least sort of objectively say, okay, here is a level of K at which we are explaining a huge chunk of the data with a fair level of confidence compared to, say, K equals 24, where our uncertainty goes way up because of the variance in the model. I mentioned we looked at this two different ways. This is the one individual from each of the different populations and the cultivars. And we see here that in the cultivars, we have this nice, very strong gray cluster. It is represented strongly across the range in a number of different populations. The only other really strong cluster we see is here in Tennessee and the southeast. There's individuals here from Georgia, Alabama. It's a little bit in Kentucky. There's one from Maryland, Minnesota. Okay, so it's not perfect. It's not 100% the southeast, but it's very strongly the southeast cluster for the most part. And then we have all these other genetic clusters that it's detecting, but there's no sort of semblance of regional structure to this genetic diversity. So what would give us a whole bunch of genetic diversity but not appear to be regionally oriented in any sort of way? Does anybody have any ideas about that? Okay. If you have a high degree of selfing following occasional outcrossing, what ends up happening is every generation of self-pollination, you lose 50% of your heterozygosity. But you can also end up with divergence of alleles in that whole process. So you may end up, say you have, you know, big A, little a by big A, little a. Well, 25% of your individuals are going to be little a, and 25% of your individuals are going to be big A. And if they keep selfing, you end up with all of this diversity that can be located in one area, and it's kind of maintained, and it's not regionally apparent because of the degree of selfing going on. And so that's what we think is happening here. The other thing just to highlight is roughly 20 to 30% of these populations have a pretty strong influence of this cultivar from the, or this cluster from the cultivar. So there's a high degree of introgression that's going on from cultivated black raspberry into wild populations. If we look at clusters of individuals within a location, so these are each different populations, it indicates that within a location, we're seeing fairly homogeneous groups, for the most part. It's not 100% that way, but for the most part, within a location, they're fairly homogeneous, but they're very different, well differentiated from one another when you move across to different populations. So you can very easily look at a single population and know what population or what location it came from by comparing it to a bunch of individuals. So absolutely, this appears to be the influence of a high degree of self-pollination, which is kind of interesting because black raspberry, Rubus occidentalis, and the sister species in the west, Rubus leucodermis, are really the only two diploid members of the subgenus Idiobotus that are self-compatible. Red raspberry and all these other ones typically are self-incompatible in the wild. And so they have methods of enforcing outcrossing not present in black raspberry, and we're seeing the effects of that right here. When we look at this range-wide, you can absolutely, just to give you a little bit of context of how this looks on a range-wide basis, there is sort of this light blue, I will point out this light blue cluster here that creeps up in a number of locations, this light blue there. And actually, when we look at this at a lower level of K, we'll just say K equals 11, just to kind of give us a better idea of how things are hierarchically arranged. You see a little bit more continuity regionally. This light blue is still present very strongly in some cases. Well, it turns out that that is the same cluster that our cultivars are in. So that's probably, that light blue cluster is probably the influence of introgression events from our cultivated germplasm. So just a bit of a summary with this. Cultivated blackberry, black raspberry, we have very low genetic diversity, but there's a lot more genetic diversity in our wild populations. The wild black raspberry populations tend to be quite homozygous within a location, but they're also very heterogeneous and sort of divergent from one another geographically. So if we continue to sample wild populations, I'm sure we're going to continue to find a lot more diversity across that range. That would not necessarily be the case if we were looking at something like balsam poplar. And somewhere between 20 and 30% of our wild black raspberry populations showed significant admixtures with cultivated populations. And we believe that's most likely from escape of either pollen or seed over time into wild populations. A whole bunch of people that worked on this and were helpful in putting this together. Too many to say everybody's name, but a lot of people. And I think maybe we have time for a couple questions. Yeah, Ed. The virus? Yeah, so that's a whole nother level of what we're looking at. It has more to do with the mechanism behind each resistance gene. There's a couple of different levels to look at this. One is, if you have an individual plant that is resistant amongst a whole bunch of plants that are susceptible, are you going to get virus coming in? And then the other way to look at this is, if you have 50 acres of resistant plants, if you have virus coming in periodically, are you going to see secondary spread of that virus within the field? And so that comes down to how these viruses are transmitted. The viruses are phloem limited. And so the aphid has to penetrate and probe and salivate into phloem for a period of time before it is able to transmit the virus. And there's actually a student in Corvallis that was looking at this a few years ago. And what she found essentially was that there's very little salivation going on into phloem. In fact, the aphids seem to be hitting phloem and not even recognizing when they hit phloem, and they go right past it and they just continue looking for sap. So that's a good sign. I think that the odds of any individual plant, if you have a heavy virus pressure, any individual plant getting virus, are eventually it's going to happen. If you have a 100-acre field, are some plants going to get virus just from aphids coming in, landing, feeding, going, they're going to pass the virus and then they're going to split because they're not going to be happy there. The other thing that we found out was that the aphids, the resistant plants, aphids may stop on them for a while, but there's very, very low fecundity. So they aren't able to successfully reproduce and colonize these plants. And that's the main thing. So the real power in this is that if you have a 10-acre or 50-acre or 100-acre block of resistant plants, are you going to get some virus? Probably. But you're going to see very little spread, secondary spread of that virus within the field. So it's going to be a manageable issue for the most part. That's a great question. I'm going to let Jill go into that because she's been working on that.
Yeah, so we are different from each other, but they seem to be everything during an hour. But I do believe that that is a different position to the shield.
Yeah, we did some crosses to sort of test these early on, and some of the segregation were, I mentioned earlier, with the source of resistance from Maine, we had an excess of resistant plants, and so that makes it, since we don't know exactly what's going on with that source of resistance yet, that also makes it hard for us to interpret some of the segregation ratios and really understand whether things are really co-segregating or how separated they are. Yeah.
So you mentioned accession selected in Rich Mountain, South Carolina, and two different contexts. One of them was your nearly homozygous selection in your genotype. The other was your most vigorous plant out of the field. I'm guessing these are not the same selection.
Yes and no. I mean, it's the most vigorous in the field, it was a seedling population. So every plant in that field was unique individual, except we did have cultivars in there as checks that were clones for comparison. As a whole, that population was very, very vigorous. Also, it was with the SSR markers that we tested, there were 100% homozygous and homogeneous within that population. So there were some wild populations that we could not distinguish between any of the individuals that we germinated from that seed. So it was very highly inbred. I think the vigor, how much of that is a disease tolerance sort of thing going on, because there was significant verticillium pressure in that field, and they scored lower for that. There may be some other factors going on. I will say this one from Rich Mountain, South Carolina, we took one individual from that, and that was the individual that was chosen for sequencing the genome because of the high homozygosity. And I think the SNP rate was one in every 2,500 bases, roughly, which is really low. I mean, compared to other genomes, you expect it to be more like one every 100 or so.
So where I was going with that question is, how confident are you that it's actually pure oxymetallics? Is there any opportunity for other species to have contributed to the genome so that it's different?
The marker alleles that we saw were not unexpected alleles. In fact, I don't think there were any rare or unique. There may have been one. I don't know if there were any rare or unique alleles in that population. Phenotypically, it's very typical occidentalis. It just happens to be isolated. And actually, what we find is that around the edges of the range are where we see the most homozygosity and the most homogeneity in a population. Sure.
No. So,
it's a great question.
From a practical perspective, if you're interested in breeding or germplasm conservation distribution, why would you be interested in a K1? I would think you would want to stretch your K value further to access more diversity to make your study useful.
Right. I guess the way I would turn this around is I would argue that what we really should be interested in identifying is what is the biologically relevant K for what has been sampled. If you have sampled a huge range of geographic diversity and the best K to explain that data set is 1 or 2, then you're probably not adding anything relevant or a whole lot relevant by going to a bunch of different locations. Okay, so it's not necessarily that we are choosing to look at K at those levels. We're trying to identify the K that best explains the genetic diversity that's been sampled. And in the case of balsam poplar, if I was a balsam poplar breeder, which thank God I'm not, but if I was a balsam poplar breeder, I would be I would be terribly disappointed with a K of 3 because I would know that there is, you know, I can sample a little bit up here and I can sample a little bit here and a little bit over here. But unless I find something really unique phenotypically, I'm not going to be bringing in a whole lot of allelic diversity by doing further sampling. Whereas in black raspberry, because of the breeding system and the isolation of these things, what this allows me to do is I can say, well, this population over here had larger than average fruit size, but I also know that it shows a high degree of admixture with cultivars. So those large fruit alleles probably aren't anything new. This population over here appears to be clustered totally differently. Those are the alleles that I want to bring in so that I can start screening some stuff. And it gives you some sense of, okay, with a high level of K, I know that's reflective of the breeding system and the fact that there just isn't a whole lot of gene flow going on between these subpopulations. More sampling is really gonna bring us a lot more diversity that we can look at. In fact, I sent the repository. I went to Boston. When it arrived? Yeah, I was in Boston a few weeks ago. My wife was at a veterinary conference, and we went out and went to Concord and looked at some of the Revolutionary War stuff and Paul Revere's Ride in the Trail and stuff. And I'm like, oh, there's black raspberry. I just stop, collect black raspberry, send them back to the repository. Any other questions? All right, I think it's time for our break then. Thank you.